Hello, everybody. I'm Bob McCallum. That is John Shannon.
Is that a Friday thing? You get into your DJ mode?
No, I'm not in my DJ mode.
Oh, no, not again. I'm sorry. I brought it up. But it's much better when you got a bit of a cold and you're a little more nasally in the deeper voice.
Well, it's not. Those are two entirely different things. Not nasally. Well,
you did both of them. You did both of them at the same time there.
No, it's affected. It's not nasally. Hi there, everybody.
Ball outside.
Yeah, just a little bit high. So this is our final show of the year.
What?
Well, it's our final live show of the year.
Okay.
You haven't given me any time off all year.
No, and you know what? Because you haven't worked that hard. You haven't. Come on.
Okay, here's the quote. I've done more for you than your mother. She only carried you for 9 months. I've carried you for more than a year.
So listen,
actually,
you used to do
actually,
3 hours
I've carried
hours
you for
a day.
About 10 years.
You used to do 3 hours a day, Bob.
Yeah, but there was a lot of commercial time. I don't get to get up in the middle of this thing and, you know, go have a cigarette or a cup of tea or something.
We used to call that exercise. Here. Just exercise.
Man. Yeah, well, I don't get to exercise anymore. Anyway, here we are. So we're not going to disappear here. If you're listening to the podcast or listening on Sirius XM, we're going to have best ofs, assuming we can find any.
Oh, there's some good ones.
Well,
particularly before, actually, there's a lot of good ones before we've got on Sirius. And hopefully people will enjoy them on Sirius.
Like what?
Well, like what's my favorite of all these, all the shows we did prior to being on Sirius, because all of the ones after we were on Sirius are my favorites. The George Strombolopoulos one we did in the spring. That was outstanding. Don't you think?
I'm the wrong
person. Oh, no, because you can't remember yesterday's show.
Who was on yesterday?
Exactly. Who's on first? So, I mean, from that perspective, I think there's lots of good listening, even though you can go into the library and find any show that you want. But I think that for the Sirius XM audience, I think there's some good shows that we're going to put together.
It'll be fine. And they'll listen or they won't listen. And it doesn't matter to us one way or the other. Well, right. It does, but we hope they listen. But if there's shows that you've missed or perhaps would like to listen to a second time, that's what we're going to give you for the next couple of weeks, and then we'll be back in early January. So to end this, one of my favorite guys, our friend Keith Oberman, will join us from New York City, and we'll get into the baseball lockout and COVID and all kinds of stuff. So stick around. Enjoy the show. We'll begin with Mr. Oberman after these messages. Well, it's McCallum and Shannon back with you, and look what the cat dragged in.
John Buccabella.
John Buccabella.
Buccabella.
That's right.
Keith Oberman is with us. And for those of you who are just listening and not watching this, he's got a Montreal Expos jacket on. The blue jacket with the stylish M on the front. Look at you.
Yes, sir. Ebbetsfield Flannels, the company I own a little portion of. Just came out with this, and I'm not trying to sell it to you, but I figured it was appropriate to wear.
We don't need to see the flannels, okay?
All right. That's all right. It's not that kind of flannel, John, for crying out loud. Okay. They're very nice old baseball, and they make old hockey stuff, too. Very, very good material.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Looks great. Now, you went a few times to Parc Jarry, I'm told.
I did. When I was 10 years old, and I was so intrigued, it seemed like such an impossibility that you could play baseball in a different country, that I prevailed upon my parents, and my dad and I went up in 1969 and saw Willie Mays playing for the Giants at Parc Jarry, and he enjoyed it, and he wasn't really that much of a baseball fan at that point, that we came back with my mother and my sister the next year and made it a real vacation on it, and got on the train and went to Quebec and got wow. seats in the observation car. And 2 hours of the trees were great. And the last 2 hours, even I was bored by it. But we had a great time. And then we also had plans. My father had plans for all of us to move to Montreal in the event that the draft was still in progress as I got out of high school. So I have some ownage of this, Jack. This isn't just gratuitous because I'm on with you guys.
I get it. Well, don't you, I mean, every now and again, I think back fondly to Parc Jarry.
Oh, yeah.
And to a lesser extent, Exhibition Stadium in Toronto. Two not Major League Baseball fields. But there was something, like especially Jarry Park, there was something very quaint and special about it, wasn't there?
There was, to my experience, now remember, I grew up in New York, and the year that I went the first time was the year of the Miracle Mets, and the Mets were something that had not been seen in New York before in years, a lively, excited crowd that for a while anyway didn't care whether or not the team won. And even in that contrast, it was like being at a circus. There was something constantly going on, and people were excited, and there were the organist played twice as loud as in any other ballpark. It was as much fun as I've ever had at a Major League Baseball game, and the team was just dreadful. I mean, it was Rusty Staub and then Ron Fairley, and then it dropped off very quickly to 8 consecutive John Bacabella appearances, and you know, you just... It's like, well, they're having a good time, and that's what counts. And the whole experience was great. And the fans were great. And where are you from? You're from New York. You came here just to see us. It was very, very, we were very much welcomed. We had a very great sense of that. And, you know, that I was a schoolboy student of French, and I could actually understand 60% of what was being said to me. It was great. Wow. I met a guy who sold baseball cards and hockey cards at his biscuiterie, Monsieur Bertrand, and he sent me the Opeachy sets of 1969 and 70 and would sell them to me at cost and put them in the mail when that was an impossibility in the States. And it was a great time. Absolutely. And the ballpark was the only problem was we went in August. So it was already, you know, might as well have been winter and aluminum seats in that ballpark. And my backside is still cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about, you talked about the Mets that year and the Expos that year. My memory of the Miracle Mets was that the Expos contribution to them was Don Clendenin.
Yep.
He ended up being traded to the Mets and helped played pretty good first bases, as I recall, for the Mets down the stretch.
Won one of the World Series games with a home run and was basically straight up for Steve Renko, the trade that the Expos made. It wasn't one of their better deals, but yeah, it was the Expos were, it was exciting, and it really did sort of change my perspective of what a ball game could be like, because going to Yankee Stadium in those days when I was a Yankee fan as a kid was like going to study hall. I mean, and you could hear the second baseman talking to the shortstop. At Jarry Park, you could not. My father sitting next to me had to shout to be heard over the organist and John Bacabella to give it the real enunciation. And the fans and people yelling in French and people yelling in English. It was wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
I'm curious. You talk about your family. Bob's told us many times over the years about his dad was a fastball pitcher, correct, Bob?
Yep.
And my parents were really sports oriented.
Yeah.
Your love of sports, your love of this, did it come from your family?
Yeah, mostly because there were several incidental factors, but the baseball fan in my family was my mother, who was a Yankee fan because her father had been a New York Giants fan, and this was the easiest way to irritate him. So she had gone to Yankee Stadium when she was 5 years old, accompanied by her uncle, who had a friend in a wheelchair who he pushed up several gradients to Yankee Stadium. And the first day that my mother went to a Yankee game in 1934, they used to stand by the player's entrance with this kid who was in the chair. And my mother met Babe Ruth, the first game she ever went to, and got a baseball from Babe Ruth. No the kidding. First game. So after that, everything was pretty much of an anticlimax for her in terms of baseball. But she knew the game, and she was a big fan. And later on, we had season tickets, and she went obviously to as many games or nearly as many games as I did. She would go to 60 games a year, and all the playoffs and World Series as the years went by. And I would guess, I don't know. I mean, she was from the time she got the Babe Ruth ball to the time she got hit by the Chuck Knoblauch ball during the 2000 series or 2000 season, a very famous error that was made by the Yankee second baseman. I don't know how many games she went to, but it might have approached 1,000 games. So she was the fan, and my father was betrayed by the Yankees when he was about 19 or 20. They traded away his favorite players in consecutive seasons, and he gave up on them. He said, "They will break your heart, and they will ruin you. Watch," and they did. And they broke my heart and later betrayed me and ruined me and tried to ruin me anyway. So that came from them. My interest in hockey was outside the family, largely in great part because the school I went to had a hockey program and I was the announcer. And that was sort of the origination of that. Mm. And it was at my dad got us tickets to go see the Rangers, usually on Sunday night. And he enjoyed it very much. He had never been to a hockey game. My mother's side of the family, I had an uncle, my mother's uncle who took her to meet Babe Ruth, was a New York Americans fan.
Wow.
Who sort of reluctantly in the late 30s went, "This is a sinking ship," and attended, if I have it correctly, I believe this is true, attended Brian Hextall's hat trick in the 1940 finals. And if that is not hockey fan pedigree, I don't know what is.
I don't know exactly how old you are, but you're not old enough to remember the Dodgers when they were in Brooklyn, are you?
No, not quite. They moved 2 years before I was born. I'm 62.
Yeah. So,
man, you're old.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't even speak to this, but if you live in Manhattan, mm-hmm. and the Dodgers were in Brooklyn, is that like another country?
It depends. A lot of people would treat it as such. Vin Scully tells the story of the Dodgers winning the 1955 World Series at Yankee Stadium. And as soon as they got out of Yankee Stadium and went through the Bronx and into Manhattan to go back to Brooklyn, it was fall. The baseball fans just left the streets. There was no sense there had been a baseball season, and it was over an hour and a half earlier. It was football season. You could almost see, he said, only in my memory, he said, I see kids on every street corner throwing a football back and forth to emphasize, okay, we're done with this. He said, then you get in the tunnel and come out on the Brooklyn side, and it was the 4th of July times Christmas times 10 New Year's Eves. So they are, because historically they were separate cities. There is still some of that. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Bronx, which is where the Yankees play.
Yankees. Yeah.
And, but I have relatives who had a candy store across the street from Ebbets Field. So the first time when I walked into Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, I heard voices in the back of my head say, "Don't go in there. Don't go in there. That bastard stole our food from us. Took the food off our freaking tables. Don't go in there." So there's a mix of it. And there were plenty of, you know, I had my father's best friend was an arch Dodger fan, and he was from the Bronx. So there was plenty of that sort of side by side stuff that transcended the boroughs. But I don't know how many Yankee fans would have been in Brooklyn. I know there would have been Brooklyn fans scattered throughout Manhattan and the Bronx and the other boroughs and the suburbs. But if you were in Brooklyn and you were, say, a New York Giants fan, you probably did not survive childhood anyway. So,
yeah. Well, and I was going to say, because if you go to Chicago, you know, there's the, you know, Cubs, White Sox, North Side, South Side thing. If you go to, you know, Southern California, the Dodgers and the Anaheim Angels.
Different countries. Never mind.
Well,
do you know? You know, when I moved to LA, we carried, my station carried the Angels games, and I went as sports director of my station when I was 26 years old. First time I went to Anaheim and took the trek down there, which if you hit the traffic wrong, if you hit the traffic right, you should be able to do it in an hour and 40 minutes. If you hit the traffic wrong, it's what day is today and what day will I get there? And it was one of those days. And the PR director of the Angels asked me, said, as an outsider, somebody new to this, do you think that our problem getting publicity and attention equivalent to the Dodgers has anything to do with the fact that we're here in Anaheim? I was like, yeah, I mean,
No kidding.
Halfway through this trip, I was thinking I should have brought a suitcase for the, you know, staying over here tonight, for God's sakes. Those are two different worlds. Chicago is, to my experience, you know, every building has a Cubs fan and a White Sox fan in it. It's sure. Not Sprite. The ballparks are the two different parts of the town.
All right, so how do you become a Jets fan versus a Giants fan? How do you become, Rangers Islanders explains itself. Like, what about the old baseball days? The baseball giants, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the New York Yankees. How do you explain that? How you fall into it? Is it purely what your family, what your father mostly told you?
But you don't have to go back very far to go to the time when Brooklyn was a different city. My grandfather, who saw Christy Mathewson pitch when he was a kid, was a New York Giants fan who saw, he doesn't have, his memory started after the American League War. But his parents and the kids, even the older kids that he grew up with, were there for when the American League just said, we're in business and we're stealing all your players, which either made you an American League fan or made you hate the American League for life. And this is one of the things baseball has lost in the erasure of the league's identities. The establishment of interleague play comes at a cost of erasing these. I don't know why I hate the American League, but my great-grandfather apparently stabbed a guy because it was an American League, National League argument in 1904. And these things have been completely erased. You used to have a rooting interest in the World Series, no matter what the team was, based on which league they played in and which league you were a fan of, and that's all gone. But in this city, it owed mostly to history. Most of the Giants and Dodgers fans obviously became Mets fans. I don't know how the Giants-Jets thing worked, because I grew up in the 60s, and both of those teams, with the exception of the Jets championship year, were not only disastrously failures, but so boring as to disinterest most people in professional football to begin with. So I can't explain that. They play in the same stadium. It's kind of like,
nothing's changed.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, the baseball thing is most, as I said, my mother was a Yankee fan because it pissed off her father. And that's what better reason is there?
I guess none.
Yeah.
While we're on the topic of baseball, sort of, we're in the midst of a lockout here. We are all three of us old enough to know what this is all about. Although this doesn't feel, Oberman, to me like it did back in the 70s and 80s. It doesn't feel quite as serious, quite as contentious. Or am I missing something?
Well, obviously it's the off season. So the sense of being able to perceive the burning building and then perceiving that you're in the burning building is a lot less just based on that. Also, it is an action by the owners, and nearly all of the previous labor issues have either been pure strikes taken by the players at their own will or forced strikes, but it's still the players taking the action. So those are the primary difficulties and differences. And, you know, it's very hard to prove a negative. You know, that week before the lockout started, baseball was getting more attention than every other sport, including the ones that were active. Mm-hmm. Billions of dollars being thrown around, and Max Scherzer signs an 85-year contract, and this, and what do you mean? How can they possibly have any financial trouble? Somebody just got $340 million for 3 weeks, and then flatline. And the thing, once again, is I don't know who's benefiting, and who could possibly be benefiting from the flatline. The owners are not making the money that they made from the publicity the week before. So I don't understand the logic. I think they think they could scare the players into something, but they've thought that since 1876.
What did you make of the owners and the MLB taking likenesses off the websites?
I thought that was handing the players a victory. The owners were very good this time and very disciplined about saying, you know, we have been forced into this action, as if, you know, somebody had a gun to their heads. And it's like you widen out the shot and they're holding their own gun to their own heads. But they lost that immediately. As soon as the players are they might as well have all had V from Vendetta masks on there instead of the blank image. It's just like, okay, you've just martyred the union. Congratulations, the lockout's going really good, Rob Manfred, Cornell class of 1980, punk kid a year behind me in school. It's this guy has been waiting to do something like this all his life. He went to the labor college at Cornell, and 9 out of 10, maybe 99 out of 100 kids there are socialist, communist, union organizers, the children of mine workers. Some of them were trapped in mines as kids. I mean, these are still the farthest left in American society. I know them and love them. And I took classes in there too. And I put myself in that category. But one out of every 100 went to that college to find out how to break labor in half. And that was Rob Manfred. So.
Well, I mean, have you, I don't know how closely you followed this thing, but is there an issue that you think is the real key or stumbling block? Potentially?
The hill to die on.
No, they, and that's the other thing. There is no evidence of something so magnificently important that it justifies this action, or would have justified and might yet justify a strike by the players. This is like the most disastrous of the early labor actions, the one in 1981. And I was the 22-year-old rookie reporter for CNN when this thing happened, when they lost 50 games in the middle of the season. And it was over compensation for free agents, but not compensation for all free agents. Ultimately, the union went out on strike because the owners were going to unilaterally impose a system that would, I believe, wound up resulting in six teams losing one player each as compensation for free agents. And they lost, after, in 1981 money, they lost $125 million over six guys, because the essence of baseball labor is different than all other labor in this country and all other sports in the world. It is still, as I said, my grandfather's older friends remembered the war between the American League and the National League. These owners have nothing to do with the elimination of the reserve clause and the establishment of free agency in 1976, but it's like it's a religion with them. One day we will get our world back, and we will have our plantations, and players will be ours for life. And when we develop a player, he'll stay in Pittsburgh until we let him leave, and his family has to stay too, and his kids. And they still believe this, and I'm fairly close with the family of an owner, and he tells me some of the stories about how these guys start going about, you know, Phil Wrigley told me, and Tom Yawkey used to say that the day that Marvin Miller showed up, and they're still fighting a war from 1975, and it's just another expression of it. Does to them, all hills are hills to die on.
Well, you know what? You're probably not wrong. And yet, this same group spent how many billions of dollars in the weeks leading up to this lockout?
Yes, exactly.
And did it essentially because they knew the lockout was coming. We better spend now while we can, because we sure don't want to wait until March or April and then get into a track meet with all the other owners. You know, they defeat their own case, don't they? Over and over again.
Yes, because 9 out of 10 of them are successful businessmen in other fields who come into baseball, mm-hmm. and they make the same mistake that everybody else who's done that for 150 years has done, which is, I'm going to apply my experience and expertise and show these baseball owner amateurs how a real business is run. And instead of, you know, manufacturing candy bars or computer chips or whatever it is they've made their money in, they are faced with an intricate system with an intricate history in which labor and union and management want to not just find some sort of middle road in which they have a slight advantage, but they want to kill each other. So this is the naive owners coming in and thinking they can accomplish something that all the other naive owners in the past failed to do.
And yet, don't you think that the Major League Baseball Players Association is still the most powerful of the four sports unions?
Yeah, it has, to some degree, John, lost some of that. The last really kind of belligerent but manageable leader, Mr. Shapiro, who died, I want to say now it's 12 years ago or 10 years ago, had just sort of the right touch. And I don't know that Tony Clark, the former Detroit Tiger and Yankee and Met and lots of other first basemen, giant guy, good fielder, good hitter. I don't know, because he grew up in the world of baseball in which all the profits were already made. You know, there was already the guarantee was you come and you make the major leagues, you've already made more money than Carly Ostrzemski ever made in one season. You know, that was, and that's his floor. So his sense of I'm protecting the rights of the players for 30 years from now, or I'm ensuring that the that we're not subject to these limitations on our whatever. I don't think he has that. I talked to Marvin Miller the week before he died, and Marvin was complaining about, you know, the backsliding by the union. And I was like, well, Marvin, with the momentum that you put behind this, the average player's salary went from like $16,000 to roughly $16 million. Don't you think the momentum is still going? And he was like, I worry about it. I don't want to leave this earth without being. And I was like, okay, I think you won this one, Marvin. But it's a fight unto itself, and it does not follow even the convoluted worlds of hockey or football or basketball labor.
It's interesting because I've talked to a few friends. We think that probably in the next year, Donald Fehr will leave his post at the NHL Players Association. And the question becomes is, do you need a lawyer to run the union, or can you go with a former player, like, for the sake of argument, a guy like Glenn Healy?
Yeah. Well, you'd know more about whether or not you want to trust Glenn Healy with your union money than I would, but I may not.
Hold on, you're still a Ranger fan, aren't you?
Oh no, I'm not a Ranger fan anymore. Not after. Not
okay.
After,
well, we're going to get into that. We're going to get into that.
So. Not after John Davidson was shown the gate. That's it. I'm the last New York Americans fan. I'm picking up where my great uncle left off. I don't know. I mean the backbone to sports unions tend to be a combination. They didn't do as well as they could have because football players are really difficult. They're like herding cats. But the NFL Players Association, when it made most of its breakthroughs and proposed things that were then considered communist and were later proposed by the owners in every other sport, like 5 years later, like sharing revenues, 55% of the gross, the NFL, that was a labor lawyer named Ed Garvey, who was a wonderful guy, hilariously funny guy, and a very intelligent, monstrous Oakland Raider named Gene Upshaw, who was also a wonderful guy and very smart, and just, but did also have that added sense of bringing to the table the fact that he could break the table and then break it over your head. So they were an excellent combination. And when Ed left and Gene took the union over and then had some lawyers around him as assistants, there seemed to be a lack of control. In other words, it became all the, you know, put your head down and win this as you would as an athlete. And I'm not trying to disparage athletes, because as I said, Gene was one of the smartest people I ever met and one of the most honest athletes I ever met, who once told me off the record, he said, yeah, I know you got a story that says the strike is going to end tomorrow. This is in 87 because the players are going to cross the picket line. He goes, you can't quote me, but it's true. I didn't, you know, I wanted you to know you're not making a fool of yourself on TV. I mean, that's the sort of thing Gene did, but he just, you need an outside, I think you need in a union, an outside figure of importance who is there to lend a kind of, not teacher necessarily, but your high school or college advisor, the guy who's just there to say, yeah, you guys are doing it right, or no, this is the way I would do it right. This is how you fill out those forms. That you need them, and whether he has to be the front guy or the 1B guy, I don't think that makes that much difference.
We got to take a quick break. We'll come back with more. We got lots more to chat with Mr. Olbermann about. Keith Olbermann is with us, and we'll continue after these messages. Keith Olbermann is our guest. You're chortling there at the sound of the sirens.
I'm loving the fact that it is so warm that Olbermann's on his balcony.
On the balcony.
Doing the show on his balcony. It's, you know, it's warm here in Eastern Canada as well, so it's hard to believe it's December.
Well, also, I don't really want to go inside in case the Omicron variant is available in my in my hallway or something. I don't stay as much time. It's 60 degrees out here. I might as well enjoy it.
Yeah, it was about that here too. Yep. We want to get to some other things, but you know, this labor thing is really interesting to me. I remember having a conversation with David Stern, then NBA commissioner, while they were in the midst of a strike lockout. And Stern said to me definitively, and I think he said it publicly thereafter, we have $5.5 billion for player salaries. He said, I don't care what they do with it. I'll give them the $5.5 billion. You can give it all to Michael Jordan. You can give half of it to Michael Jordan, or you can split it equally among all the players. He said, I don't care. I thought it was the most brilliant strategic move I think I'd ever seen in a negotiation. And I wonder sometimes why the owners in baseball who have revenue sharing wouldn't say, look, we have revenue sharing. The rich give to the poor at the ownership level. You know, you're worried about guys making $600,000 as a rookie. You got guys making $35 million. Have some of them give some money to your lesser lights. What do you think of that?
Well, you've just circled back to the point that I made before the break. The guy who thought that up, like, just give the players, as you said, $5.5 billion or 55% of the gross. That was Ed Garvey. That was the head of the Football Players Association. And I was on because I got to know Ed very well. We used to send Christmas cards back for years afterwards. Ed and I were on a CNN sports roundtable show with Furman Bischer, the great Atlanta columnist, in 1982. And somebody else asked Ed to explain the 55% of the gross idea. And Furman Bischer said, "Sir, I believe you're a communist." And he was serious. and that's exactly what I meant. Within 5 years, it was the NBA that went back to its players and said, essentially, here's 54.5% of the gross. You figure out how you want to pay the players. And it is so simple and so honest, but it does then require the players to make the tough decisions on the granular level of who gets the money. And the one thing that Garvey was worried about was that, you know, the union would then become the quarterbacks union and the place kickers would get, you know, $50 under the table and then they'd be cut once a week or whatever would happen. That was the drawback to that, exactly the point that you're making as a simple solution to it becomes incredibly complicated if Max Scherzer of the New York Mets then has to decide how much Thomas Nido of the New York Mets is going to make. Yeah. And that's the complication.
That occurred in the NFL? All the quarterbacks get the money and the kickers get replaced every third week?
Yes. And they said, and that's the way we're going to do it. Yeah. Because those other players have been declared essentially fungible. And if you have a sport like that, if you have a business structure like that, that's ultimately where the infusion of lots and lots of money winds up, I guess. But, you know, Garvey, I just find it so hilarious that Garvey was, I mean, I still to this day, it's almost 40 years later, I'm sitting there and I went beet red and looked at Ed like, I'm sorry, I didn't think he was going to call you a communist on TV. And, you know, you told the story about Stern. I was at the end of the Larry O'Brien era at the NBA and covering their negotiations. And one day, Bob Lanier, who was the head of the Players Association, while we were sitting around in very, very, you know, close talks with the players and the owners, it looked like they were going to go on strike. I want to say this is 81, 82, or it might have been 82, 83. Bob Lanier said, took me aside. He said, I got to tell you the story. You can't use it. Maybe you can use it someday. He said, so they said to us, you know, this is how much money we have. And if you go on strike, four teams will go out of business immediately. And another four teams will go out of business if there are no playoffs. And we said to them, yeah, sure. And Lawrence O'Brien said, you want to see the books? And we said, sure. And he said, give me the phone. And he called the office, says, I'm bringing over the union. They're going to look at the books. Yeah, give them the real books. All right, I'll be there in 5 minutes. And they walked over and they brought the union's money guy. And the union's money guy went in and looked at the books. And he came out in half an hour. He said, can I meet with my player leaders, please? And they went out into the bathroom or something. And Lanier said, the guy looks at me and goes, no, they're not telling us the truth. I think they're being too positive. If we go on strike, six teams will go out of business now and five will go out of business if there are no playoffs. And they settled the same day. So there's something to be said for that being the actual root. And the NBA has had very little labor friction as a result of that.
Well, I think we all, we, Yeah, we all remember when Larry was the commissioner of the league in the late 70s before Magic and Larry yep. came in. And those basically that's how the league was saved. It was yep. it was essentially bankrupt in the, what, 77, 78, somewhere around there.
Yep.
They had nothing.
Yep. Well, I mean, if you try to explain to people that the NBA playoffs were shown weeknight games were shown on tape delay at 11:30 right. in New York. And by the way, that was the year that the Knicks won. The Knicks' first championship was not shown live in New York because they were terrified it would reduce attendance.
Well,
even then it was worth a laugh.
Olbermann, I'll tell you a better story. Early 1980s, I was working at Global Television in Toronto and did a show late at night from 11:30 to 12. You know, this was before, this is after ESPN started, but it's a show similar to what you guys did. And I flew down to New York, met with the guy who was the president of NBA International, and bought the Canadian television rights to the NBA. Are you waiting?
I could guess, yes.
$1,000 for the year. $1,000. And the entire concept was, my show was on 11:30 to 12, was to tape delay a West Coast game and put it on at 12 midnight. So it'd be about an hour and a half behind when it was actually played. Now, we never wound up doing that.
Right.
But that's where the NBA was at.
Yes. Yes.
International basketball rights to Canada for $1,000.
What was the last time an NBA team went out of business outright was in the mid-50s. But sure. the Chicago, there was a team in Chicago. There was an expansion team in Chicago where they went from 9 teams to 10, if I remember correctly, in 1961. And they lasted 2 years in Chicago and moved to Baltimore and became the Bullets and now are the Washington Wizards. But that was the NBA was down to 9 teams in the heyday of Bill Russell and the 11 championships of the Celtics. And you could always get a ticket to see the Celtics in Boston into the 80s.
Oh God.
But not the Bruins.
But didn't they do double headers at the Garden too?
The
Sixers would play at one in one game and the Knicks would play in the other one?
Constantly. There were probably, I would say into the mid-60s, certainly there were probably 20 doubleheaders, NBA doubleheaders a year at Madison Square Garden. I don't know how many of them they did once they moved to the new place.
While we're waxing on our eloquently, I hope, sure. on our history.
Yeah, we're this is a get off our lawn show.
Yeah, we're up to 1967, everybody. Let's talk a little bit more about the granting of the Expos franchise.
Well, let's talk about what's going on now. You mentioned COVID. You didn't want to go inside. You're afraid that somebody's going to have the virus. Well, a lot of people have the virus.
Yep.
And a lot of, I would say right now, there are probably as many or more athletes, major professional athletes, that have contracted the virus than at any time during the pandemic.
I agree.
And you got to wonder, will they turn the clock back? The only place it's happened, Keith, is here in Ontario. I don't know if you heard this, but.
Yes.
Yeah.
Raptors, the Leafs. Right.
And.
That should tell you something.
Oh, Ottawa.
Yeah.
Ottawa Senators. Well, yeah. half attendance, which I think is a ridiculous thing. You know, I mean, if you're gonna shut it down, shut it down. But where are we going with this, in your opinion?
Well, let's look at the most urgent problem, which is relates to the Olympics. I don't understand why it's. I mean, they you can't just at this point say, guess what, the NHL is not going to the Olympics. By the way, nor is anybody from Canada nor the United States. We're not going. It makes no sense. You might have to stay there for, I don't know, what happens if there's another travel ban? That's my concern. I mean, if you're looking at the Omicron variant was responded to by shutting down all travel from South Africa, even though it didn't start in South Africa. And many people portrayed that as racist or biased against poorer countries or something. And other experts that I heard said, no, if it buys you an extra day to prepare for an outbreak here, it's worth it because it's not going to be permanent, but it could be a couple of weeks, couple of months. What happens if that happens relative to China while all the athletes are in Beijing? How, yep. When are you going to get them all back? It could be months. And we're talking about the healthy ones, not the sick ones, because there may not be travel. And the assumption that, you know, oh, well, we'll bend the rules a little bit for the Olympic athletes, I don't think that would be in play under those circumstances. So that's the first thing. What I sense is, because, as we know, the NHL is vaccinated except for the moron in Detroit who should have to wear, instead of an A, he should have an AV on there for anti-vaccinated. It's really strange. I don't think the leagues are going to shut down. I wonder about whether or not the Canadian-American border is going to be an issue, because it's already, you saw it play into what, when Calgary had its first outbreak and they left a couple of guys home rather than take them to Chicago in case mm-hmm. they got stuck in Chicago. What if we have some sort of delay or short quarantine or longer quarantine at the Canadian-American border? What happens then? That's my concern going forward for the rest of the season, because the leagues happily, for all the people who are tested positive, the number of symptomatic athletes in these sports is very, very low because we have a vaccine and a booster that happens to have matched up perfectly with this variant. And that's great news. But, you know, anecdotally, there's the story around New York is that everybody has or has had this variant, but New York being so highly through the third shot, the statistics are through the roof, that, you know, nobody's sick, but they feel like, you know, last week when I was kind of tired, I bet I had it. And I found myself walking one of my dogs today. I ran into a friend and I said, yeah, you know, last week, I think I may have had it. And if that's the case, the problem then becomes, would you send the Toronto Maple Leafs to Dallas under any circumstances where, you know, very few or less than around half the people are vaccinated, let alone, I don't know what the numbers of boosters are there, but not many. Would you do that? Or the Raptors to Dallas? Would you send them to Florida where there's a lot of vaccination, but very few boosters? I mean, these are where it becomes a subject of concern. It's very specific. And I don't know. I mean, I have been asking a lot of your countrymen, particularly the hockey knowledgeable ones, if the NHL has a plan in a worst case scenario to say, okay, we're going to change the schedule from the rest of the season on. We're going to declare this the midpoint. And the second half of this season is going to be played with the NHL Omicron North Division. And we're just going to go back to that for the rest of the year. I mean, is there a backup plan? Because otherwise you're going to have, as I say, if the border becomes an issue, what happens to the NHL season if you don't go to an all Canadian division and stop international travel? What do you do then?
I think it's a really good question. You know, we talked yesterday on the show about why would you even do an All-Star game in Vegas? Why would you even do that? So,
well, also in Vegas, where the vaccination rate, I think, is still pretty low.
And it's not like you couldn't get other diseases in Vegas while you're at it. Let's wipe them all off the table right here.
If you were a hockey player, would you go to the Olympics?
Not a chance. I was seriously thinking about this during the dog walk. It's like, would I go to New Jersey right now in fear that they, you know, what happens if they seal the tunnel behind me because this thing is so moved so rapidly? I heard a number on the all news station just before we started this. The number of infections in this city has tripled in the last month. And this is, I think we're above 90%, with double vaccination shots. And I don't know the booster number. I was looking for it and couldn't find it. But this is, New York is probably the safest place if you don't want to get very sick from COVID in North America, maybe in the world, or one of them, having been at the other end of it at the beginning. But, you know, I can't imagine that the odds, they might get away with it. You might go to China, you take the trip, you don't get sick, you don't get locked behind a quarantine. It's possible, but I would think that every passing day it seems less and less likely. I don't know what the point of it is at this stage. And the NHL players and the teams have to believe, have to assume that they could be without their players, not for a matter of a couple of weeks, but for a matter of a couple of months.
Well, there's an assumption, and I've chatted about this too, that the decision to go or not to go, I think it's assumed to be a collective decision. In other words, the Players Association will collectively decide whether the players will go or won't. And that's not going to happen.
Right.
Each individual player is going to have the right to do it unless the NHL steps in. And Bettman has already said, and I know John's going to dispute this and say he can change his mind, which I guess he could.
He's from Cornell, too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Another
one of other losers. We make up for it. We have the president of Taiwan was in my class. Okay.
Congrats.
There's this level of it. And John, maybe you know more about this than I do, but there has to be a larger issue in which the governments of Canada and the United States say, we're not sending, you can't go and travel internationally when we can't guarantee you that you can get back. I mean, this is stupid, and I wonder if at some point they will never postpone the Beijing Olympics voluntarily. It will not happen voluntarily,
No. But
it can happen in a de facto way if the largest countries say this is crazy. And I watch as much international news as I can, and you look to what's going on in Europe and say, well, that's the U.S. and Canada a week to 10 days from now. And they are precipitating targeted lockdowns in most European countries, because no matter how less fatal and less dramatically dangerous this variant is, it moves 2 to 3 times faster than the previous one. And you still run this risk of the hospitals being overwhelmed and hospital people being overwhelmed and healthcare workers being overwhelmed and sick and having to stay home because they're sick. This doesn't feel to me like it's going to be as consuming a problem as the first few weeks of March 2020 felt, but I think there are similarities to it, and I think the closer we get to it, I still remember this one. I'll analogize it this way. The Sunday before everything shut down, I wrote a piece for ESPN saying that these were the reasons we should urge the cancellation of the NCAA basketball tournament. And my masters there said, we're not in the public health advocacy business. I said, well, okay, I think you need to look at this as, would you rather have this piece come out now or just put everything in past tense and we'll run it again by the end of the week, because they're going to cancel the tournament, because that's how fast this is. Oh, I don't think so. But I at some point, I think there will be a de facto cancellation of the Olympics. So let me put it that way, at least by the U.S. and Canada. Why it's not just NHL players, it's everybody else who's going there. Why would you send them? Why?
Well, why would you? I mean, look, I was going to say, why would you go? But we also understand that to these athletes, this is it.
I understand.
It isn't about 10 seasons or 12 seasons of professional sport. A handful get to go to multiple Olympics. The vast majority get one shot and they work their whole lives to get it. And they're probably sitting there looking in the mirror and saying, do I, don't I?
Yeah.
You know, and I think we all sympathize with that. And I don't think we all know, we don't know what the answer to that question is for the individual athletes. On the outside looking in, it's obvious. Yeah. Don't go.
Well, but here's my question to you is, I begin to think, and this is the similarity, I begin to believe truly that the more, with every day that we proceed towards that day of do you go or do you not go, that by then I don't think there'll be any choice to be made, and it will be either the one
you
thing
that, right.
The one, and at some point for these athletes it becomes a little easier if they have somebody to blame, and if it's the Prime Minister of Canada or the President of the United States, and they can blame them for costing them this opportunity, that might make it actually a little bit easier. And it just is so much smarter, because you don't know the vaccination status of every athlete going on these two teams.
And remember,
by the way, everyone they're going to face when they get there.
Yeah.
And remember, we're also talking about 3 weeks from now when the decision is made after all this holiday travel.
Yeah.
exactly. we're having the boatload. People are still traveling. LAX. Right. I saw pictures of LAX yesterday. It was crazy, and that's going to change a lot of this stuff.
Well, too. Just if you can see behind me, this is the tourist zone of Manhattan, and where I live is there's a bunch of hotels and the streets are annoyingly filled with tourists again. And I would say the percentage compared to the winter of 2019. It's probably 70-75% of what we had then in terms of, you know, just people here and having a great time, and we're glad they're here. But my God, they're going to be taking something home with them, and it's not going to be memories of being near Keith Olbermann's house.
Yeah, Christmas in New York will have a completely different connotation for the next little while.
What did you get for Christmas? Omicron.
Hey, we can chat all day. You know that. We're out of time. We wish you a happy holiday season. It's nice to see you a week before Christmas, and especially out on the balcony in 60 degrees.
I'm telling you, the first few years of climate change are wonderful.
Yeah, what, climate change? What's the problem?
Yeah, seriously.
Right? Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, and Merry Christmas to you both and a Happy New Year, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
You got it. Thanks, Keith.
Cheers.
Keith Olbermann. We'll be back after these messages. And we're back. McCown, Shannon, and our thanks to Keith Olbermann.
He's one of those guys
I could talk to all day.
Oh, I know. Yeah, all day. I think we almost want to make him an honorary Canadian. He loves our country, loves our sport for sure. How about the fact though, literally doing the show on his balcony outside in New York City because the weather's so warm.
Well, I'll tell you, I was out shirt sleeved today.
Yeah.
You know, dumping cardboard into the bin in front of my house. And it was hot, but it was
18 degrees today.
Yeah. Warm. It was warm. That's about the end of that. We're not going to see any of those days for another 3 or 4 months or five.
Nope.
As the cold weather is coming our way. Mr. Shannon, it has been a pleasure over the past 12 months and more. And I wish you and your family, Mickey, the kids, a happy holidays. Merry Christmas. And look forward to seeing you in the new year.
Merry Christmas, Bob. It's been fun. And Merry Christmas to the guy who keeps it all together. And that's our buddy, Hugh McLarty, who's done a marvelous job.
You betcha. Hugh, good job, pal. Stick around and wait. Maybe there's a Christmas bonus.
Maybe not.
For the gang here, Merry Christmas to you too. We'll see you next year. Goodbye, everybody.